Hello, everybody. Just taking attendance here. Good to see everybody. During Alan's sermonette, I kept focusing on these lovely new sippy cups. I mean, he was talking about water. These were inspired by me, because I can't take a drink without shaking. Oh, wow. Lemon. I can use both of them today. It's fantastic. It's good to see everybody. Particularly nice to see Jan Voiner this week. We've been worried about you all week, and you look as lovely as ever. I hope you're doing as well as you look. Yes, we are taking a trip. We'll still be here next week, but we'll be gone Pentecost. I'm embarrassed to say that we planned the trip, and then I realized Pentecost was during the trip because things are so late this year. You know, we didn't realize that you could have a Pentecost on, June 16th this year. So we are taking a trip out to Seattle to see our daughter and her husband. Then we're going to be in a cabin on the Olympic Peninsula and traveling around the Olympic Peninsula. And then the next thing, there's about five things going on. But the next thing is I will travel to Sandpoint, Idaho on a beautiful lake and spend time with the four young men whom I shared a house with at university, in the University of Montana. Most of them happen to live in Idaho, and it's been 50 years since we've been together. I think there was actually a law passed saying we could not get together anymore, but the statute of limitations has run out, and we're getting together. And my wife and I have this understanding. If I were to ask her, what's the happiest time you've ever spent in your life? She's allowed to say it was the years I was in Brickett Wood in England. You know, you'd like her to say, oh, it's the years I've spent with my delightful spouse. But it was before she knew me. She had so many friends who believed the things she believed, and it was a beautifully gardened place with fantastic food, their own dairy herd, and still enjoying the fruits of that today. Well, my, like, most outrageously happy time, I've had some wonderful times since, was the time when I lived with these four other guys. I didn't have too many cares. My parents were actually paying my college tuition in those days, so all I had to come up with was room and board, and we had some fantastic times. They were, I still am grateful to God that he put me together with friends who had a good outlook on life and good morals. You know, at that point in your life, you can go so many different directions. And they actually chose me. They were looking for someone to work on their forestry crew for the summer who played guitar. And I played 12-string guitar at the time. So that was, pardon the expression, instrumental in my getting together with them. And then one of the young men was getting interested in God's way of life at that point. And so he's the one who led me into the church. So they were extremely good years. We laughed and we joked and we studied and we cooked and we, I remember we would order a side of beef every year. We had a freezer locker and we would go out and pick produce and things. We were so organized. The forestry school was very suspicious of us because we had such a good time. And they couldn't figure out these five guys living in this house. I remember one time we were walking to university, which was four blocks away, and we took different classes, so we didn't all go at the same time, but this day there were four of us walking, and Fred was leading us, and Fred was our old, mature, wise person. Fred was probably like 22 at the time. We would only have been 20, so we would go to him with our life questions and things like that. But we were walking to the school, and we saw this group of foresters. Just the phrase is funny to me. A group of foresters observing us. And we knew we were under suspicion. And at one point, Fred said, on the count of three, we're all going to skip the rest of the way. And I think we were wearing our logging boots and things, because that's what we did. That's what the cool foresters did. So one, two, three, we skipped the rest of the way. And our reputation was clad in stone from that day on. We, like I said, we ran a household. We thought we did pretty good. I know we often, we were in Missoula, where there was a Missoula church. This would have been 1972. And we often had church people come in for a meal or something after services. And the other three guys were quite fine with this. And they knew a lot of the church people and still would know the names today. And I remember, you know how it is with guys. And I remember being at church and hearing Janet Thompson tell one of the other women, you know, at their house, you could eat off the floor. And the other woman said, oh, they take that much good care cleaning it. And she said, no, there's just a lot of food on the floor. And I don't even want to talk about cleaning the bathrooms, but we had a good time. And particularly, I remember the spring of 1972 when we were all just getting together and we were flush with the happiness of finding people who got us and we liked each other and we had a good time together. And that's always been my favorite time of year. I didn't realize at the time that it would have been the days between unleavened bread at Pentecost, which is still my favorite time of year. And I want to talk today about another group of young men, and they were young men who were together at that time and other times too. I want to talk about the group that we call the 12, Jesus' 12 disciples. They weren't apostles yet, and I don't want to talk about them individually very much. I'm not including Paul. Paul is definitely an apostle, but he wasn't around in those days, and I'm not talking very much about all the faithful women who also helped Jesus Christ in his ministry. So I'm leaving out half of the people of God at this point. But I just want to talk about that group of young men. And they were young. I mean, if Jesus was 30 when he started, roughly, then probably the other men were younger than he was. And it's possible that Peter might have been a little older. We know he was married, and he just seemed to sometimes act a bit older at that point. Not all the time. I know there's a millennial joke about how do we know that Jesus was could work miracles? And the answer is, do you know anybody else in their 30s who had 12 good friends? I mean, it's just so hard these days, you know, but it was a gift from God. They helped him logistically with the work that he was doing. But also, you have to think that they had a good time. They were young. They were mostly what we would think of as bumpkins. I mean, they came from Galilee, which was sort of like the North Ridgeville of that area, you know. And there were some more professionals. But even when, you know, when they became more known for their speaking and their miracles and things, people would say, wait, aren't these nobodies from Galilee? How do they get off doing all this stuff? And they were unformed. There were at least two sets of brothers. Of course, Peter and Andrew were brothers, and James and John. There might have been more, because we know that Matthew's father's name was Alphaeus, and there was a disciple whose name was James, the son of Alphaeus. And so it's, you know, could it be there were more Alphaeuses than one? But it's possible that there were interconnections. Actually, we know from the book of Luke that Peter and Andrew were actually partners in the fishing business with Zebedee and with James and John. So there were a lot of interconnections there, and it seems like Jesus knew Peter and Andrew and James and John possibly from growing up in that area around the Sea of Galilee. Let's turn to the first book of John, John 1, and read about some of the things that took place when Jesus first was forming this group of 12 young men. In John 1, and starting in verse 35, and you can see how unformed these people were, and in a way a little naive and a little gullible. Matter of fact, Jesus even makes that comment. Verse 35, the next day, Jesus had been baptized. The next day, John was there again with two of his disciples, and this is John the Baptist. When he saw Jesus passing by, he said, look, the Lamb of God. When the two disciples of John, heard him say this, they followed Jesus. And turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, what do you want? And it wasn't, what do you want? It was, well, what do you want? And they said, teacher, where are you staying? And he said, well, come and you will see. He was probably had rented a cabin or something at that point. And they went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. It was about the 10th hour. And one of these young men was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, who got his start as a disciple of John. In, I think it's the Orthodox Church, Andrew is a name they have for him is the Protokletos. You know, like that sounds a little bit like Parakletos, the word for the Spirit of God. But Protokletos means the first called, and apparently he truly was, but soon other people were called. And in Mark and in Matthew and in Luke, we have the story of Jesus calling the men out of their boats. But for now, we're in John 1. Verse 40, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, was one of the two who heard what John had said and who followed Jesus. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah." Now that's a pretty bold statement. I mean, if I said that to you, you would probably report me and have me institutionalized, but that's quite a thing to say. And he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of God." Basically, he said, "I'm going to call you Cephas, or Peter, as we call him today." I don't know what I would do, you know, if I met somebody and they said, "I'm going to call you Raphael." Where would that come from? But that was their encounter. It's possible they knew each other and were on good enough terms that Jesus had already given that some thought. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." This is a new name. Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And this was so exciting to them. They were just ecstatic about this because they'd been searching. Well, as Nathanael says, and don't say I didn't warn you, Nathanael says, "Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Meaning that bunch of hicks? Why are we getting a Messiah from Nazareth? Well, Philip said, "Come and see." Well, Jesus saw Nathanael approaching him, and he said, "Well, here's a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false," or as it says in some translation, "in whom there is no guile." And you have to think there's a little bit of sarcasm in here that, we sang the hymn, Praise You the Lord, and it talks about spreading his wings for to shade thee. Well, the Lord was definitely shading at this point. He was shading Nathanael. He was mocking him. "How do you know me?" Nathanael asked. Jesus answered, "Well, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you." So apparently he was privy to that conversation. And Nathan said, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the Son of Israel." And Jesus said, "Wait, you're believing because I told you I saw you under a tree? You shall see a few greater things than that." And he added, and Jesus wasn't good at keeping his mouth shut at this point. He didn't have to go on, but he said, "I tell you the truth, you shall see heavens open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Well, in most budding friendships, that would be a turnoff. But in this case, they were looking for someone exactly like that. And so it was quite a thing for them. And let's just turn to Luke's account of the fishing boats, Luke 5, because it's in Mark and it's in Matthew. Luke 5, verse 1. One day as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, which is Galilee, with the people crowding around him and listening to the word of God, he saw at the water's edge two boats left there lying by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, so he's stealing a rig at this point, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little from shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And that was a pretty good idea because he could back up from them and address quite a big group at that point. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch." And Simon said, he didn't say this, he said, "Oh, right, like you know a lot more than I do about fishing. And we haven't caught anything yet, but hey, if you say so, I will let down the nets." Of course, he had already heard from Andrew at this point about Jesus. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So there's three things going on here. A, Jesus was right. B, Peter was going to make money on this. And C, if he didn't do something quick, he was going to lose money on upkeep of the nets at that point. So they signaled their partners in the other boat, which would be James and John, by the way, to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats so full that they began to sink. He's made his point, effectively. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." And that's quite a poignant moment. For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken. And this would come back in play later. And so were James and John, the son of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on you will catch men." So they pulled up their boats on shore, left everything, and followed him. A very strange turn of events. They gave up their private business and followed Jesus Christ at that point. And what makes it even more poignant is that John and James left their father in their boat. We know that from the other accounts, Zebedee. Well, I can't help but thinking that Zebedee knew that this moment was coming. He had probably seen Jesus grow up. There's reason to think he was Jesus' uncle. And he probably was prepared for this. But at any rate, they left their father in the boat, as young men will sometimes do, and went and followed Jesus. Did any of you learn a song when you were young about the 12 disciples' names? I did. Guess what I'm going to do right now. There were 12 disciples Jesus called to help him: Simon, Peter, Andrew, James, his brother, John, Philip, Thomas, Matthew, James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon, Judas, and Bartholomew. Bartholomew was sometimes known as Nathaniel in the book of John. Matthew's other name was Levi. Thaddeus was sometimes known as Judas the Zealot, and also in one place he's known as Lebbaeus, which may have been his last name. So there were a few different names to go around. And in Mark 3 and verse 13, what a nice touch. We see the appointing of the 12. It says apostles, but they're disciples at this point. Well, it says apostles. Jesus went up on a mountainside and he called to him those who he wanted, and they came to him. And it says in the book of Luke that he prayed to his father about this. And he already knew these men. He'd already called them from boats. He'd already met them when he was baptized by John. But it was a loose group, and he was making it a little more formal at this point. Verse 13 again. Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12, designating them apostles. Not all manuscripts have that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach. So it wasn't just to help him, he was training them, and to have authority to drive out demons. What, you can give that to people? These are the 12, and then he names them. It's interesting, though, that when he comes down to James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, the sons of thunder, that's because they wanted to call fire down on a village. And again, the Lord is throwing shade at that point. That was their nickname. But you know, when you're messing around with a group of friends, you do that kind of thing. So he sends them out. They were apprenticed to Jesus. They had seen him work at this point. They weren't a stranger to the things that he did. But in Mark, let's see, Matthew 10. In Matthew 10, starting in verse 1, he called his 12 disciples to him and gave them authority to drive out evil spirits and to heal every disease and sickness. Then he names them, and then he gives them a clear set of instructions and tells them how they're to behave, but they are to teach, they are to preach, they are to heal, and they are to cast out demons. So they had been apprenticing with him at this point, and the amazing thing at this point is that they did it. If Mr. Thomas told us to scatter out to the towns and teach and preach, heal people, and cast out demons, we would be A, terrified, and B, I'm not sure we could do it. I'm not sure that I have the faith. I don't know if you know, if I knew that it was the Messiah himself, that would be a little more incentive. But at the same time, maybe it was to their favor that they really didn't know what they were doing. Maybe they just had that much faith. And it's amazing at this point that Jesus trusted them that much, but they did it. And in Luke 6, Luke says that he, at some point, might have been a different time, that he sent out 72 people. But let's see, I might have the wrong verse. Anyway, whatever verse it is where he sends out the 72 in Luke, when they come back, oh, there we go, it's in Luke 9, I'm sorry. Luke 9. And they came back, well, I don't have it exactly right there, but Luke 10. If we go through the whole book of Luke, we're bound to find it. Luke 10 and verse 1, after this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town to the place where he was about to go. So they were the warm-up crowd, and this is separate. There were, as you just saw, there were other places in Luke where he sent out the 12, but they came back in verse 17. This is what I want you to notice. The 72 returned with joy and said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. So they did it. And there's indications that after Jesus sent them out, he went and did his own preaching without them at that point. But it's incredible that early in Jesus' ministry, he could send these people who kept showing over and over again a lack of faith and understanding and support, at the same time could go out and joyfully heal people with the power of God. Of course, it was God who was pointing people towards the true work that was going on at that time. I wonder how we would feel if a prophet showed up with 12 young men, said, we're coming to Cleveland, we're going to do a campaign. Remember campaigns from 50 years ago? Our church did campaigns. They had music, and they had entertainment and slideshows. The 70s were big on slideshows. But how would you feel about it? You know, me at age 71, if a bunch of under 30-year-olds came and said, we're going to tell you how to do things, listen to us, well, I would grumble, and I would say, well, they haven't been around as long as I have. They don't have the experience that I have. And yet, that's what Jesus was using for this work that changed the world. And you have to think, you know very well, like Reagan's just back from ABC, when you get a bunch of young people together, even though they're stupid, they're kind of inspiring. They're very inspiring. You know, just the fact that they're young and healthy and effervescent and just full of joy and energy and all kinds of things, they can accomplish so many things. And you know, you can think of so many great people, men and women, who've accomplished things in their youngest days because they were just full of not necessarily the Holy Spirit, but full of the Spirit of life at that point. And so it was a bonus to him. It was a gift from God to give him these 12 men with whom he could joke and laugh and burp and snore and smell like smoke and drink beer or whatever they did. You know, they did things together. It was a gift from God. Peter had a wife, but the others don't seem to be married. When Jesus talked to them about marriage, they got a little perturbed about the whole thing and said, well, why would any of us get married? And it seems like that they were single, and of course that would have helped. And you know, there's the verse about John's disciples coming to Jesus and saying, well, why don't your disciples fast? John says, we fast. We know that the world is a sordid place, and we fast to come out of it. And what did Jesus say? He said, look, John had his work. I'm going to have a good time. That wasn't the words that he used. He said, while the bridegroom's with them, they're going to rejoice. And it was one of the perks that God gave him, because Jesus knew from the beginning, A, he knew that one of the 12 was not on level with the others, and B, he knew that there was only one way out of this ministry and one way back to his Father. And it involved some pretty horrible things. But in the process, God gave him some gifts that he could enjoy at that point. And so they didn't fast. Jesus fasted, but the disciples didn't fast. They, in a way, had as good a time as they could on the road and in the fields. Remember, they were criticized for picking food and eating it on the Sabbath, because that's what they did. I'm hungry. I think I'll eat. So they walked through a field, picked the gleanings, and ate it as they were allowed to do. And yet, they were a royal pain a lot of the time. There were people in Jesus' ministry who got Jesus, you know what I mean, who understood him. People who had faith, the centurion. Jesus said, never have I found faith like this in Israel. There was the father whose daughter was healed. There was the woman who used her own hair and lotion to wash his feet. She was that devoted to him. Why didn't he pick people like that? People who'd already been tested and people who'd come out on the good side, and instead, that's not who he called. What was he up to? There are so many ways that the disciples were disappointing that we could spend hours and hours talking about them, so I'm just going to list them quickly. Try to keep up. They didn't get his parables. They asked for explanations. They grumbled. They questioned his methods. They rebuked people who brought children. They threatened to call down fire on people. They didn't understand what he said about marriage or how hard it is for rich people to enter the kingdom of heaven. They slept while he was in turmoil in Gethsemane. They deserted him and fled. They criticized washing his feet as a waste of perfume. They argued over who was or would be the greatest. They even got their mother involved in that one. They acted like tourists at the temple. They didn't believe people who said they had seen him risen. Thomas didn't even believe he had risen. Even at the very end, they said, will you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? Jesus chided them and made fun of them. I think it's funny, Acts 1, a little bit off the subject, but Acts 1, the very end, this is when they've just said Jesus has been through everything, the resurrection, explained things to him, and they say, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And if I were Jesus, I would be, yeah. What have we been doing? Well, it's interesting to me, of course, that he's taken up in a cloud and he disappears. Well, at that point, they were looking intently up into the sky as he was going. And after he was gone, and they stood there. At that point, even the angels got a little snotty with them. And if you look in verse 11, two men in white came down just to make them close their mouths and do something, said, men of Galilee, why do you stand here looking up into the sky? So even the angels were scolding them at this point. This same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way you have seen him go. And yet, this motley crew, Jesus treasured them. If you turn to Matthew 19, and verse 28. And this is after a particularly poignant exchange, which we will talk about how it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. But in verse 29, Jesus said to them, and they were all there, I tell you the truth, at the renewal of all things, when the Son of Man sits on his glorious throne, you who have followed me will also sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or fields for my sake, which they did, they left their father in the boat, will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. So those jobs are taken. If you thought you were going to be the king of the tribe of Levi, the job is taken. It's interesting that he handed those out to these unformed men at this point. When they grumbled in John 6, and they did grumble, I mean, in my translation, it uses the word grumble in John 6. He was talking about, giving them his flesh to eat. And in John 6, starting in verse 60, on hearing it, many of his disciples said, this is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life. The flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you are spirit, and they are life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe, for Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him. He went on to say, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has called him. And from this time, many of his disciples, not the 12, but many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Well, Jesus was at a low moment at that point, and he turns to his group and he says, you don't want to leave too, do you? And Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. We believe and know that you are the Holy One of God. And Jesus, with maybe a slight bit of bitterness, said, have I not chosen you, the 12, and yet one of you is a devil? And yet, he must have been pleased by what Peter said, and he must have kept those words in his heart, and they must have encouraged him in the things that lay ahead at that point. And you know, there's the conversation in Matthew 16, but also in Mark and in Luke, where he turns to them and he says, in Matthew 16, down to verse 13, he was talking to people and telling them how they had little faith. The disciples forgot to take bread and, you know, there was an issue and all that. And they didn't understand what he was talking about. And he turned to his disciples and said, who do people say the Son of Man is? And there were various answers. Some said John the Baptist, some said Elijah, still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say that I am? He was probing. Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And so he went on to tell Peter that he would play a very special role in things. Even when they argued about who was the greatest in Luke 22, and this was at a terrible time. This was right before that Passover supper, and the food was prepared, and they were going to do the foot washing and all kinds of things. And in Luke 22, starting in verse 24, he's already talked to them about somebody's going to betray them, and a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them. He could have lost his temper at that point, but he was very kind. And those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors, but you are not to be like that. And he goes on and talks about how important it is to be humble and to be a servant, and it's possible that this is when the foot washing work in. But he does say in verse 29, after these people arguing about who was going to sit on what throne, he says, I do confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So that still stands. Even don't forget, when he sent them out to do the work, they did it. And they came back joyful. So they could be frustrating, but at the same time, they were his friends and his supporters. He confided in them. He predicted his death clearly to them. He told them specifically that he would be in the grave 3 days. It didn't sink in. He took them with him when he met with Moses and Elijah. They were confused by the whole thing, but they observed it, and later on in life, they recalled it. He washed their feet. He comforted them in John 14. Let's turn to John 14. You know, these are the words that we have just heard at our Passover service, because that's what was going on here. And he says in verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. And he goes on to comfort them in great detail at that point. That's what's on his mind. He knows he's going to die the next day, and yet he's there comforting and strengthening this group of people. And in John 15, in verse 15, verses that we know very well, let's start in verse 13. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father I have made known to you. And of course, these are verses that mean a great deal to us with our own relationship to Jesus and to God the Father, but he's specifically talking to his pals. Yes, they were his servants, and they did what he told them to do, even when they didn't understand it. but he was emphasizing that they were his friends. And he spoke very clearly in these chapters of his love. The word love just comes up over and over again, and how much he loves them and the Father loves them. My group of four guys and I have never talked about that. We've never said how much we love each other. If I knew I was going to die the next day, it's possible that the conversation would come up. But we just don't do it. But Jesus wasn't afraid to do that. He put it in very clear terms, and it's written down for us. He took them with him when they left as his last human lifeline in his hour of need. And before he left, I wonder if he didn't stop and look at this motley crew of 11 men at that point and think to himself, what have I got going on here? He knew what their fate would be, by the way, because he had already told them in these verses that they would be tossed out of synagogues and they would be put to death for preaching the word, and they were going to do it. And he knew that he had to prepare them for that kind of future, that they had to have that kind of strength. And in some ways, you could look at the disciples at that point and they would look like a failed venture, because even then they weren't getting it. What game was Jesus playing? And when I use the word game, I'm, of course, not talking about really a game. I just mean, what was the plan at that point? His ministry is over, but the one thing he is still doing is tending to the 11. And even when he rises from the dead and comes back, he has other things going on. I mean, one of the most significant things about that time of his life between unleavened bread and Pentecost was the amount of time that he wasn't there. What was he doing? I think he was having a good time looking at the earth, rejoicing with his Father. But at the same time, he would come back and he would kid his pals, because that's what they were. And he did rebuke them for not believing the people who said that they had seen him after he had risen and they didn't believe him. And he did chide Thomas and made him touch his wounds and things. But he was tending to the needs of those people. He eats with them. He comforts them. He makes fun of them. But he gives them special personal instructions at that time too. And you know, like in the last chapter of John, the things that he speaks to Peter and John. The 11 are incomplete at this point, and what's the one thing that he drums into them over and over? And it doesn't make sense to them at the time because they want to go fishing. But he says, no, you go to Jerusalem and you stay there and you get ready. And it wasn't as though he hadn't told them about it, because in John 14, he had told them that he was going to send them a special gift, a gift that would prepare them for the work and would make them recall all the things that they'd been through and would strengthen them and would give them a direct connection to God and make them the very children of God at that point. It was there at the beginning. You know, in Mark 2:22, he said, no, I'm not calling the people you think I'm calling. I'm calling new wineskins. Old wineskins aren't going to work. I'm not going to call elders and deacons. I'm going to call bumpkins and tax collectors and zealots and fishermen. That's who I'm going to call. And I'm going to stretch them in my own way so that they fit my work. And they need to be different from what people think is going on right now. They need to look at the whole world in a different way. They were nobodies from Galilee, but he grew them into his team. And then, as it says in John 16 and verse 12, I have much more to say to you, more than you can now bear. But when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. He will not speak on his own. He will speak only what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. He will bring glory to me by taking from what is mine, where he is, and transferring it to the earth where it's needed, to the minds of those people, men and women. All that belongs to the Father is mine, and that's why I said the Spirit will take from what is mine and make it known to you. And as you know, we're coming up to the day of Pentecost, and that's exactly what happened. They were there. They were assembled along with a bunch of other people. The Holy Spirit descended on them. They were never the same. They went out to the entire world at that point, and you know, that's why you're sitting here. That's why I'm here, and the message still goes on. Because they were not incomplete by the time when Jesus left them on earth, but after the day of Pentecost, they were ready. Well, did they grow old? It seems like many of them were martyred, and yet a lot of the accounts that we have come from false churches and false believers, and so we don't know. I mean, you know, there's endless churches with the remains of St. Andrew or St. Peter or other apostles. We don't know if they were martyred early. It seems as though they were. We know John lived a long time. Did they look back on the time when there were 12 of them gallivanting around Galilee in real heat, enjoying the teachings of their Lord and hearing them with their own ears and recalling it now with the power of the Holy Spirit? Did they get a thrill out of the gospel writings when their own brothers, Matthew and John, wrote down what had happened at that point? Because, you know, written books were not that common at that point. Did they read them and think, well, I remember it a little differently? Or did they read it and think, yep, that's exactly the way it was. Oh, I'm glad I have that, because now I won't forget it. That'll always jog my memory in that way. Did they spend their lifetime thinking back on the foundation of those 3.5 years? Jesus probably still thinks about them. There's more to come. Just as I'm going to a reunion and getting together with 4 20-year-olds who happen to be in 70-some-year-old bodies, there's going to be another reunion. And you know, on that day when we're all raised and we're meeting the Lord in the air, there's going to be all kinds of mini reunions. There'll be the grand reunion of the family of God at that point, but there will, you'll also hear laughter, and there will be 11 guys over there, maybe 12, because there was a replacement for them, and they'll be palling around with the King of the universe. They'll be palling around with the Messiah, the Christ, the Lord of the earth. They'll be his pack of old friends, and he'll have jobs for them, but by that time they will be accomplished and seasoned, and he will say to them, "Well done, my good and faithful pals." I look forward to the day when those 12 are reunited with their Lord and back in action.